accession number 19598, Real One.
Don Featherstone, Real One. Where were you born, please?
I was born in London, in Kensington, North Kensington, in March 1918.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in North Kensington?
No. My father came out of the army in 1919, and we went back to Paddington. We went to live at my grandmother's house in Paddington, and near Paddington Station. And I was brought up there till 1923. And we moved back to North Kensington. But in 1925, my father walked out on us, and we went back to Paddington, where I lived until I got married in 1948, short of the war. Of course, I was away during the war in two basement rooms in Paddington, where we had to have the gas on all day because it was too dark to see otherwise, with my mother and my brother.
What job did you do pre-war?
Pre-war, I stayed at school till I was 16. I had a commercial education. I had a number of jobs in London, around the city area. I was in shipping. I wasn't very good at anything. If I wanted a job, wanted a rise, I had to leave and get another job. So I had about five jobs in 4 years before the war. And I know my way around the city of London like a taxi driver, because I used to take messages, and walk everywhere.
Did you join TA before the war?
No. I was going to join it with a lot of friends of mine, the Queen Victoria Rifles, but on the night we were supposed to go and join it, which was happened to be my 21st birthday, I'd met a girl called Nancy Featherstone, and I was entranced with the fact that she had the same name as me, and I had a date with her. And the funny thing about it is I never remember anything about the date, or I remember seeing her again. Anyway, all my friends joined the Queen Victoria Rifles except me, because I couldn't get in because they were full, and they were all killed, wounded or captured on a beach at Calais in May 40.
So, do you remember Chamberlain declaring war on Germany?
Very much so, on that Sunday morning. Yeah, we had a lodger upstairs and she fell down the stairs with a baby, trying to get downstairs to avoid the air raid she was sure was coming.
How did you feel about the news?
Well, I thought it was obvious it was coming. I was full of trepidation because my father, when he was with us, and an uncle, he used to tell me graphic stories of fixing bayonets and going over the top, and I knew I hadn't got what it took to do it. So I waited a little while, sorting things out until the 17th of October, and I went down and volunteered and joined the army, and I was the first recruit of World War II in the Royal Armoured Corps. I was in a recruit out on my own at Bovington for 3 weeks, waiting for somebody else to join. I didn't mean to join the Royal Armoured Corps. I meant to join something like the Royal Army Service Corps or the Royal Army Pay Corps. But I was too fit and healthy and they wouldn't take me in any of them. So then the recruiting sergeant said, "You wear a black beret in the Royal Tank Regiment, the Royal Armoured Corps." I thought of a girl I was going with at the time, how it would impress her. So I joined that. And
what kind of training did you have at Bovington?
Well, I did the 3 months recruit training right through October, November, December until into the new year. And we were going to go down to the driving and maintenance wing of the Armoured Fighting Vehicle School there to learn to drive, you see. And this was on a Friday morning. We were all going down on a Monday, and we'd finished our other training. We were sitting around in the barrack room. And an orderly sergeant came into the barrack room and said, "Can anybody here type?" You see, well, we all sort of looked at each other, and I thought to myself, if you say yes, you're going to have to scrub the orderly room. But anyway, I took a chance, and I said, yes, come with me. So I went with him, and they were in dire need of a typist in the orderly room, and I could type a touch typist at 60 words a minute. So I came back to the barrack room at 12 o'clock with the Lance Corporal stripe up. So I never learned to drive. I'm the only man ever went in the Royal Tank Regiment and came out without learning to drive.
How had you been treated in the basic training?
Oh, very, very easy, really. When I look at things, when I look at these television programs about training people, I, I think to myself that it was, you know, it was good. Because I've always liked being with people. I've always liked being with men. I've been a footballer and all that, and I've worked in football clubs as a physio. And I've, comradeship to me is the essence of it all. And to me, the greatest thing I ever learned in life was the comradeship in the army. Everything I've ever been, I've done, or I am, I owe to the British Army. It taught me self-reliance, adaptability, respect for other people, and everything. And I'm a great one for it. And ever since then, I've always done all the comradeship things I can. I've worked as a physio with Southampton Football Club, Hampshire County Cricket Club. I've started groups. I'm mixed with different sort of groups. I go to America once or twice a year lecturing. I've got loads of American friends. I lecture at West Point, Fort Leavenworth, and those sort of places on military things. And I've got friends everywhere, and I believe in this comradeship thing.
What happened to you next?
What
happened to you next?
Well, I was at Bovington. I was in the orderly room there, and I stayed in the orderly room at Bovington. I was personal clerk to the second in command of the garrison, Colonel Gartside, and I used to take shorthand notes and muck around like that and everything, go to Bournemouth to dances. I had a wonderful time the first 2 years of the war. And then in the spring of 42, they raked us all out to make up units of strength for the North Africa landings. And they...
But had you been in any bombing by the German Air Force?
No. Very, very peaceful at Bovington. You didn't know the war was on, really. And I think we did. I remember seeing the Battle of Britain being fought over Dorset with all the aircraft and all that sort of thing. I remember that, but there was nothing happened to me. I remember coming up to London once or twice on leave, and I was bloody glad to get back, you know, because it was London. I was... My mother took it in the stride. I was very impressed. And in 42, as I say, they posted me to the 51st Royal Tank Regiment, which had originally been the Leeds Rifles, but in 1938 they mechanised them and made them 51st Royal Tanks. And I was one of the first Southerners to join. And they were a marvellous bunch of Yorkshiremen, all postmen, bus drivers, all that sort of thing. And when you spoke to them, you say something to them, and they'd look at you and they'd say, "You what?" And you'd say it again and say, "Yeah, maybe you're right." And they were marvellous fellas, and I went through the war with them. And
did they accept you as a Southerner?
Yes, I got on all right. And I was a racing cyclist at that time, I had been. And to my delight, I found out that the orderly room sergeant was a fellow called Laurie Innes, who held the London Land's End tandem record, London John of Groats tandem record, everything like that, you see. So he and I had much in common. So I had my bicycle down. We took it all around Colchester, Worthing, everywhere the regiment went, me and my bike went. And then we, in January, we didn't go on the actual start of the North Africa landings. We went over in January 43 and we landed in Bone in North Africa. We went over on the Empire Pride, that troop ship, which was the one that took the prisoners back to Russia. You know, there was all the fuss about Count Tolstoy and those sort of people. And went over on that, landed at Bone, and worked through, and we landed in mid-January, and we were in action in 23rd of February. And we went right through the North Africa campaign, finished up fighting down by Hammamet and Hammondliff, and along the beaches there with the Churchills. We were the first Churchill regiment to go into action. And the Churchill tanks that were lost at Dieppe by the Canadians were our Churchills. They took them away from us in Worthing to put the Canadians with them. So when you see tanks in pictures with Calgary on the beach at Dieppe, and people say, "Yeah, Canadian tank," it wasn't. It was a Sea Squadron tank of ours, Calgary. All tanks in our regiment had the name beginning with the, C Squadron was C, B Squadron would be Barham, Bombay, or that sort of thing, A Squadron, Agamemnon, Achilles, that sort of thing. Headquarters Squadron, which I was in, had four reserve tanks. I've forgotten what one was called, but the other three were Faith, Hope and Charity. And we had an office truck. We went around in that, this rickety old truck thing. Got hit with a shell in, I don't remember where, but caught fire. And I just managed to rescue my battle dress blouse, which was hanging up, or my khaki drill, whatever I was wearing at the time. And I've got some photographs which are all singed and burned that I had in my wallet. And they're in a drawer over there. And yes, we went through. It was a real experience. I'm not a brave man. I've got too much of an imagination. And I used to see the lads, the tanks rattling out, going out to something. And I used to wave to them and say, you know, bye, Charlie. This guy looking out the turret or something. And about an hour later, they'd come back and say, oh, Charlie Sanso's been burned to death, or tank blown up or something, you know. And it was an education in every sense of the word.
How was morale affected in the unit by these casualties?
Well, it didn't seem to affect them at all. They just took them in their stride. They were great lads. I never remember a single incident in the whole of the war with that regiment of anybody welshing or deserting or refusing to do anything. They were a truly wonderful crowd. And every year we have our old comrades dinner in Leeds, and I've been to most of them since 1947. We used to have 200, 250, 300 attend. Well, last year we had 15. So on the 2nd of October this year, we're holding our last 51st Tanks old comrades dinner. And I'm going to do the toast to the regiment, the Royal Tank Regiment, and Colonel of commanding 1st Royal Tanks coming from Germany to answer.
You said that the regiment first went into action on the 23rd of February, did you
say? Yeah, 43, Steamroller Farm.
What do you remember about that action?
Well, A Squadron were attached to a Y Division up forward. The Germans had done this Oxhead offensive, and they'd broken through, and they were holding this salient on this plateau. It was called Steamroller Farm because there was a big old steamroller in the farmyard. And we were coming up, Headquarters Squadron, we were coming up with the soft vehicles, with the petrol and ammunition, up the road. And as we were coming up, we could hear gunfire, and then we heard the crump of bombs. And when we got rounded the corner, there in front of us was this plateau leading up to this, where Steamroller Farm was, with the hills behind it, and there were tanks burning all along there. And we hastily pulled in the side of the road into a clump of trees there and put camouflage nets up. And although I didn't take part in the Battle of Steamroller Farm, I watched it from about 3/4 of a mile away and saw Holland's tank go up and saw everything that happened there. And guys were coming back in uniform. Some were burned, you know, some were wounded, and some had blood all over them, coming back and saying Lieutenant Lang's killed, and so Sergeant Brotherton kept going in his burning tank and bringing the crew out and all that sort of thing, you know. And that was our first experience.
Did it last very long?
About 2 hours in the afternoon, middle of the afternoon, about 4 o'clock-ish, 5 o'clock.
What did the men think of the performance of the Germans there?
Of the German?
What did they think about the performance of the Germans there?
Well, I don't know what we thought of them, but they thought of us. They were intercepted a wireless message back from a guy called Koch, K-O-C-H, who was commanding. He said he was being attacked by a mad tank battalion that couldn't be stopped. And we drove them back. And Hollands knocked out 2 Mark IV tanks, couple of Mark IIIs, 2 88s, 2 75s, 126 soft vehicles, all on his own. He got out of the tank, sitting on the front of the tank with a Bren gun firing at people. He was an amazing man. And then one other tank, a guy called Jock Renton, a lieutenant, took another tank up and got through to him. And Renton later on went to the South Sea Islands ran a chartered a yacht and took people around. He was an adventurous guy. He won an MC there. And Holland's tank broke down coming back, and Renton attached a tow rope to it and towed it back until they got it started again. And, a very proud sort of thing, you know. And then later on, of course, we fought as a unit in North Africa. We fought right through. Then
what was the next big battle after Steamroller?
The next battle was at Boerada, where we we lost our commanding officer, Colonel Timmis. He got shot in the eye by a sniper and lost his eye, but he wasn't killed. And the adjutant as well, Arthur Simmons, who I was talking to on the phone the other day, lives in Faversham. He was wounded as well and came away. And I've forgotten who we were working with, one of the Yorkshire regiments, I think. And we got on the top of this rise, and the infantry came up. We were always pretty successful, as I remember. I don't ever remember us getting we took some heavy casualties, but I can't ever remember us failing to do what we were told to do. I mean, and I don't accept any credit for that, because I never went in a tank. I was a guy in the orderly room who gave them who did the orders. I used to take convoys up to when the tanks came out at night and leaguered. I used to take convoys up when I was a sergeant with petrol and ammunition and food and all that sort of thing to them. And I was mighty glad to get back to the unit too. But I take no credit for it. I was not a combatant soldier. Apart from firing exasperatedly at aircraft attacking us with a rifle and a revolver, I never fired a shot in anger.
How long after Steamroller Farm was Buerada?
Oh, within two or three weeks, I think. It was. Then we got to a place called Jebel Kurnin. There were two big hills. They called it the Twin Tits, and they were just these big hills, and the Jews were up there. We went in with the rifle, one of the rifle brigade regiments, we couldn't get up there. These were too steep, but we were shelling there and supporting them as they climbed up. They knocked the Jews off them. Then we went down to Medjez El Bab and helped on the breakthrough there. And we were on a Longstop Hill, and the North Irish Horse and our brigade got a tank up on the top of Longstop Hill, which I think is still up there because they couldn't get it down. And we watched some of that, saw some of that. And then we went through the Medjez, and then being heavy Churchill tanks with a 8 miles an hour sort of speed thing, you know, we couldn't move too, I think it was 8 miles an hour, 8 miles to the gallon, something like that. Anyway, we couldn't keep up with Sherman's and the faster tanks when they were moving through, so we got left behind. And when we got down to Tunisia, down to the coast there, Hammamet there, most of it was all finished there. The Germans were in Cap Bon, and they couldn't get off, and they had this huge great camp with about 300,000 Africa Corps in there, and we stayed down there, and then we...
What part did your regiment play at Medjez El Bab then?
Just the support. We used to break the hole, you see, for the 6th Armoured Division, usually 6th Armoured Division, to go through with their faster tanks. You see, we were purely assault tanks. And... Then we stayed down in Tunisia for a bit, got into Tunis and ambled around a bit, and then we moved back into Algeria.
What was the character, the personality of Hollands?
Hollands, very quiet man. He'd been a sergeant, he'd been in another rank, a very quiet man, a soldier's officer who would, if you were on duty at night and he was orderly officer, he'd come and talk to you man to man, you know, just ordinary stuff. A very, very much respected man. And after the war, at the regimental dinners, he came every year with his driver, Mitten, and they used to arrive after lunch at Leeds at the Queen's Hotel there, and they would go into the bar, or when the bar closed, into the lounge there, and they would sit there with a beer or coffee, and they would refight Steamroller Farm. And Hollands would say, and then I told you to traverse right. No, traverse left. No, it was traverse right. And he'd go on like that, and they'd carry on and refight this battle and go over and over again every year. But as I say, Mitten dropped dead just before Christmas last in 98. And Hollands, his daughter wrote to me and told me he's completely senile and doesn't know anybody, recognise anybody and anything.
Where did he lose his leg?
On the 22nd of May 1944 at Casino, just short of the Hitler line at the Leary Valley in Pontecorvo. We went in on the 23rd at the Hitler line. But I'm going ahead of myself now. If you
tell me this now, and we can go back to the narrative later.
The Hitler, where a Cassino monastery had fallen, and the Germans were in the Leary Valley alongside it at Pontecorvo, and they'd got this Adolf Hitler line, which was a heavily fortified line with tank turrets sunk into the ground so that they were just about 3 or 4 feet up and covered with brush so that you couldn't see them, and a very, very heavily fortified line. And we, our brigade, North Irish Horse, us and 142 Royal Armoured Corps, we were in the centre, North Irish Horse on our right, 142 on our left, and we went in to break the line, and we went, took the Canadian infantry, and we had Canadian infantry, the Van Doos and the Edmontons and the Princess Pats, people like that, Canadian Highlanders, and we went in, and the two outside regiments got held up by minefields, and we went forward on our own, and we got shot up flank and rear by self-propelled guns and everything. We lost 53 out of 57 tanks, and we had quite very heavy casualties. The other rank casualties are in that book I've got there, and but we broke the line. And the next couple of days later, some of us were up there looking at our tanks that were burned out and that our Churchills, and Alexander came up. General, he was general then. Alexander came up, and he was in command, of course, and he. We saluted him and everything. He had his entourage with him, and he talked to us, and he said it was the proudest moment of his life, and that he'd estimated 3 weeks to break the line, and we'd done it in 10 hours. And of course, he was very proud of that. And but before that, we had been we'd been in North Africa through until the beginning of 1944. We didn't go to Salerno. We were doing some special training with the Canadians in North Africa. We didn't go to Sicily or Salerno, and they put us in, and our first real action was this Hitler line do in Italy. They moved us up gradually, and then we went up after the Hitler line there. We reorganised. The whole brigade had enough tanks left to form a composite squadron of 17 tanks out of three regiments, each of 57 tanks after the Hitler line. And we reorganised, and we were going up the road to Rome. It was very hot and dusty, and we were standing by the road there. We were waiting to be re-equipped with tanks and that, and a dispatch rider came up and said, the British and Americans have landed in France, in Normandy. And I remember one of our fellas, the little Billy Burnett, said, I don't give a bugger, he said. Are we going to get any leave when we get to Rome? Well, of course, we never got to Rome for months after, because Mark Clark went in and took it, and we just went to the east of Rome and went up the Adriatic side of Italy. And incidentally, I don't know, going right back, it's of interest though, because it fits in with the next thing I was going to say. When we went over to North Africa on the Empire Pride, we had to take our berets off, our tank regiment berets, and put them in our kit bag, and we were issued with khaki side hats, which we hated, with a little plastic Royal Artillery badge. And the whole regiment, 800 of us, there we were on this boat with a lot of Royal Artillery units. And of course, we knew nothing about the Royal Artillery, and they were very mystified, and all sorts of rumours were spreading around. We were commandos going to capture Rommel and all that sort of business. And it wasn't until we landed, they didn't want the Germans to know that tanks, Churchill tanks were coming. It wasn't until we landed and we'd been in Bone for some time, we were allowed to put our berets on. But going up Italy, up on the Adriatic side, the east coast, at this particular time after Rome fell, we found a hat factory, a place called Montevarchi, and we all went in and helped ourselves to hats. And I had a beautiful broad-brimmed hat. I looked like Van Gogh's Portrait of the Artist in it. And when we went up to the Gothic line there, up the Adriatic, up to Cesena and Pizarro and that area, we again had to hide our berets. And we all wore these hats that we captured. There was the CO sitting in a jeep there with a beautiful big hat on, and we all went up wearing these hats. And so as to get the Churchills, which travelled overnight on transporters, up to the Gothic line area. And then we did 11 assault river crossings in 3 weeks up there.
What were they like?
Well, they were pretty hard, because by that time We had some special bridging tanks with Churchill tanks with big pieces of Bailey Bridge either end and no turret. And you'd put the tank in the middle of the river and you'd drop the end pieces to form a bridge with the hull of the tank forming the centre span. And it was a hard job because you had to put in there and then bail out, and you had to bail out and bring your 19 radio set with you. You weren't allowed to leave it in the tank. So some poor devil had to get out the little escape hatch with a turret and get out. Bring the set. And I can't quite remember the names of these places, but we were at there was one place we were near, and the Canadians had made a big attack there, and all their bodies, we could see them lying on the hillside there, and the smell was terrible there. To Camacho, no, I can't remember the name of that ridge. It was quite a well-known ridge though up there. And it was a very hard fight up there. The Germans were retreating very slowly and were very well entrenched. And we got to, well, the Germans were very well entrenched in the whole area, right the way up to the border, you know, right the way up for miles in depth over the River Po. We were on this side of the Po then. We were south of the Po then. And we had to get across the Po, and there were a series of actions there. I can't remember them individually because they were sporadic sort of things, and we detached squadrons here and squadrons there to do things. But we were constantly in action all the way up there. And we got across the Po and we were going up toward Ravenna and that way. And then we had an incident which revolutionized my life. One night, 17th of October, it was the fifth anniversary of my joining the army, 17th of October 1944, it was about dusk, and we were lying around on our bedding we'd pulled back, we were some miles behind the lines, and we were lying around on our bedding, and we didn't know, we were near the Ronca River and there was a Bailey Bridge, and we didn't know that the Germans had got two 210mm guns, very big heavy guns mounted on flat trucks, and they were trying to get this bridge about 9 miles away, and they fired them. And we were lying there, and I was lying on my side with my elbow bent, my head resting on my fist and that. And I saw these two red dots coming towards us. And I looked and I saw them, and they got bigger and bigger, and there was this terrible noise, and everything went up. And these two shells landed in the middle of us. And there were, everybody there in that group was killed, or badly, really badly wounded, except me, and I wasn't scratched. I was covered in blood and everything from other people, but I wasn't scratched. And after that, I was a corporal then, and my orderly room sergeant, Sergeant Innes, who's still alive, and who I shall see at the dinner soon, he had a very bad shoulder wound, and he was sent back to England. And I was made sergeant in the orderly room. I was a corporal, as I say, made sergeant. And I was so bomb happy, I didn't know whether I was coming or going. And we moved up to a town called Forli, F-O-R-L-I. And we had all the vehicles in the streets, and we were alongside a convent full of refugees. And we could see in the windows there and see all these poor devils in there. And the Germans were shelling the town all the time, and they were firing guns with proximity, shells with proximity fuses, so that if they got near a chimney or a tree or anything, they exploded overhead and sort of showered stuff down. And I was terribly, terribly bomb happy, and wondered what the hell I could do. And every time anybody coughed nearly, I was on the ground. Anyway, just through the end of October, they decided to start leave to England. And my regiment got 7 vacancies. And they gave 5 to men who'd won awards. This is other ranks vacancies.